Thank you for listening to this podcast brought to you by the Center for Christian Music Studies at Baylor University. This podcast was recorded at the 2011 Alleluia Conference. In this session titled, Helping the Adult Untuned Singer, Randall Bradley explores how most choirs have untuned adult singers in their ranks. How can we assist these would-be singers? This session will offer strategies based on in-the-field experiences to help them find their voices. To learn more about the Alleluia Conference, visit us online at www.baylor.edu/alleluia.
Put it all in kind of in one place and that kind of thing. So it was very helpful for me to think through this. The kind of opening statement here is that we spend a lot of time helping children find their voices, but we fail to give attention to adults who are also in need. To fail to offer help to someone struggling as a singer who self-identifies and asks for help, and I say that it's unchristian.
Dr. Bradley, we're out of handouts.
Okay, if we can share, then we'll get some more before the end of the time. We have a bunch of handouts, and I encourage the students not to put the handouts in the rooms because they would be gone, and more than half of them were gone when I got here. So somebody has handouts, but not you. But I think when people self-identify, and particularly when they say, you know, I'm not able to sing, I wish I could you help me? And we don't do something to help them, then I think that goes against what we believe. It goes against our faith, I think. Just as medical professionals have codes of ethics regarding their commitment to help people who are ill, music ministers must assist people who are in need. To refuse or ignore a person whose spiritual life could be enhanced by his or her full participation in worship violates our calling to ministry. When we refuse to help or we ignore, we are sending the message that his or her problem is unsolvable. So that's the kind of the context from which I'm coming to what we're saying today. So I couldn't believe in this more. I think it's incredibly important. And I can honestly tell you that in the years since I've known anything to help, I have always been helpful or found somebody that could help. There was a time in my life early on when I didn't know anything to help somebody, and so I simply put the untuned person in the back and tried to make sure the microphone wasn't closed and hoped they would quit, and you know, all those things that most of us have probably done. But a long time ago, as a college student, I read an important article that really kind of transformed my thinking, and it's the one that says for helpful reading. It tells you when I was in college by the date. I actually wasn't in college then. This is already an older article. But anyway, this tells you a little bit. This was an article that I read as an assignment, or maybe I just picked it up in a music educator's journal. But I read the article, and then I've always been the kind of guy that when I read something and I need to know about it, I'll try it. Okay, I'll try it out. And I always tell my students that the worst thing that we can ever do in music ministry is not to help. Because even if you don't have a great solution, if you try something and the problem gets worse, then don't keep going in that direction. You can always try to go in the opposite direction. So I say, in a choral rehearsal, you give a corrective procedure and the problem gets worse. Well, that wasn't a good solution. So try something else, and then you can try again. So not to do anything to me is always a worse problem. And I think a lot of times we're paralyzed because we are afraid that if we help a person who doesn't sing in tune, that they will get worse or they will get frustrated and they'll feel worse and that we'll feel bad. But what does the person already know that he or she doesn't sing in tune? Not always. Not always. But most of the time, by the time they get to be adults, you know, in the process somewhere, they picked up that, you know, this is not working for me. It's not very effective. Now, that's not always the case. And there's a difference when you have the one who does know and the one who doesn't know. That's a really quite a difference. So those are some things that I think are really important. Well, how does this problem or this issue, I'm trying not to use it as a problem, but as a challenge, how does this issue affect music ministry? One is the untuned singer who joins your choir. So someone joins your choir, and the very first night, you know that this is problematic, and there's a challenge there. The untuned singer who self-identifies and asks for help, and I have had that happen a few times. Mostly for me, it's happened by somebody just saying in a social gathering, you know, I don't sing. And I would say, well, have you tried? You know, tell me about you're not singing, or, you know, talk to me about that, because I'm always intrigued about how someone would self-identify as a non-singer. And so something like that. Or a person who loves to worship, who doesn't sing in tune, and you're compelled to help. You know, you've just come across this person who just loves to offer their voice, you know, and they're not, it's not working for everybody else, and you feel compelled in some way to find a way to assist. So those are kind of three possible ways that it happens, I think. Some stories of people that I've met along the way and situations that I've encountered, and these names have been changed around a little bit. Annette is an African-American woman who joined our choir a few years ago. And this was a church that I served where we were moving very much toward trying to be a multicultural congregation because of the area where our church was located. There were many, many different cultures of people, and we were trying to be effective in that community. So when this African-American woman joined our choir, who was the only one, I was really glad about that. Well, but she told me she was coming Wednesday night, and she sang in the choir and sang in her junior high or something. Well, she showed up, and it wasn't working. And what are we going to do here? Well, I'm going to tell you a little bit about some procedures, some ways that I handle some different situations, which will tell a little about some different problems. This woman, very vivacious and fun and, you know, just a real cool person to hang out with kind of person, you know. Well, what I did in this particular situation, and this will tell you a little bit about some resources. There was a woman in our choir who teaches music education, is a music educator, and I asked this person to sit by her in choir. And I said, could you take on this project and help her find her voice and kind of give some assistance here? And she says, any good music educator, absolutely, you know, I'd love to help with that, you know. So this was Dr. Henry, who teaches here at Baylor, and so she sat by the woman, and we figured out the very first week that the soprano section was not a good place for her. Well, but after, then I talked to her the next Sunday, and I said, well, why don't we try the alto section this week? I said, your voice is a little lower, and I think the alto might be a bit better for you. Well, we tried the alto section, and we weren't successful either. So then the next week I said, well, let's try the tenor section. And then I put her like on this side of the altos, which was Dr. Henry, and then here's Annette by the tenors. And then Dr. Henry was helping her, you know, let's look at this spot and kind of just gently guiding and building a relationship and, you know, some of those kind of things. And so the tenor section started to fit for her. And she once we got her into a typically male range, then she started getting some notes right. And then you find some places to affirm, and then you start to affirm some places, and then the affirmations start to build on each other. And then pretty soon she was contributing, you know, and certainly not distracting in any way. And sometimes your goal is not to have a fully contributing person right off the bat, but over a long period of time, you get somebody that you think about functions. And, you know, first let's get to zero, and then let's move up, you know, that kind of thing. And so that one worked out really well. Once she got her voice and really learned to sing, then she dropped out of choir. And I'm not going to tell you it was a perfect story. But, every time I see this woman, you know, we have this big bear hug, and she tells me how much she loves singing in the choir and how great it was that she got to do that. And so the relationship, you know, was important. There was a man in our church when we lived in Kansas City, Herschel, and he was an older man who was challenged in as far as learning challenges and that kind of thing, some developmental challenges. And he had sung in the choir off and on. I can't tell you that I ever did anything really to help him except keep people surrounding him that helped him continue to function in the choir. And my assessment was that for me to work with him with a number of other significant deficiencies, it probably wasn't going to all connect mentally for him, but choir was important for him socially. And so I had some guys who would not be offended and would not be frustrated, or decided that the ministry was more important and not be frustrated. And so they would surround him and work with him. And he would do very odd things. The oddest thing that he did, I must tell you, was one Sunday he showed up at church with a black wig on. I mean, like a big, you know, lots of black hair. And, you know, we've got to figure out what to do, because this is going to, you know, the church is, you know, the youth are going to go berserk when they see this, you know. So every choir, you know, needs a person, I call her a Margie, you know, a person who can deal with difficult things and say, you're just going to have to take that thing off, you know. That's hideous. Why would you ever do something like that? Get that thing off. Well, she did, and she just said, you know. You know, got it off of that. What I'm not good at that, you see. You know, I'm never a good person to do that kind of thing. I've learned, because people take me too seriously, and you know, it would be too big a thing for me to do it, but she could do that and get by with it. And so we had, you know, it was always a project of working with this guy. And he could sing in unison and make it work. And it would mean that we never really got, you know, wouldn't be perfect a lot of times. But the community for him, he was a single man and was able to function by himself, it was worth it. So I'm giving you an example that I made a different choice. But I made the choice based on trying to help him, not trying to ignore him. Some youth examples. Mark was a teenager, a bright kid that showed up at youth choir one Sunday afternoon, and his buddies were singing in youth choir. This was in Fort Worth many years ago. And you know, eager kind of kid, and you know immediately it's not working. We started singing, and you know, he wasn't getting anything. I do a little, you know, extra stuff, and we try to find the voice, and you know, and play around and all that stuff. Well, you know, it didn't get any better. Next week, you know, I thought maybe we'll be catching on some experiences now. Eighth grader, you know, tough time, and it still wasn't working. Well, I noticed he was wearing a hearing aid. I picked that up the first week. So after the second week, no, that's not true. He did not wear a hearing aid. I noticed he was wearing a hearing aid at a youth function. Then I asked him, what if we tried, you thought about wearing your hearing aid to choir? And he said, well, when I wear my hearing aid around singing, it's just so loud. It really hurts me. It bothers me. And I said, well, let's turn it way down, but let's wear the hearing aid, and I think you're going to enjoy choir a lot more. Well, he wore the hearing aid to choir, and guess what happened? He sang a tune. Okay, as simple as that. He wore the hearing aid because the partials that he was not able to hear were those areas right where he needed to be singing, and he couldn't. What he was hearing and what was happening was not coming together. So that was a hearing issue. The easiest thing in the world to solve. But if I hadn't seen the hearing aid and the not hearing aid and gotten the two of those connected, then I would have, if I would have figured it out or not. So that was a good one. Margaret was a middle-aged woman who was looking for a group, looking for a place to sing, a place to, this was very early on, my very first church. I really didn't know any way to help her, but I tried and I worked with her some. She couldn't seem to get things together. And eventually, you know, needed a choir and needed that kind of thing. So we went along, and then she found another place to serve. But that was not a success story. But I just kind of made a list of people that I've tried to help or people I've encountered. Aaron, this is a guy who, a number of years ago, this kid would be with his dad at our church. His dad was a custodian, and he would be there on Sunday afternoons. Well, when we would go for youth choir, this kid was just in the church. Well, you know, I've got to get this kid in the youth choir, you know, because he's a live body in the church. So, I don't have. So, anyway, this kid, you know, turned out was not able to sing in tune at first. So, I set up appointments, And I had this kid come, I was the seminary teacher at the time. His family lived on campus, and so I had him come to my office one afternoon a week, and I gave him basically a voice lesson, and just within a few months, he was singing quite well. But this was a kid, like the next one, who would, you know, when you would ask him something, you know, what's your name, he'd say, Aaron. Because it was Aaron, but he would just kind of talk. And it was everything was sort of, you know, sort of vocal fry, you know, kind of like this. You know. Well, when he sang, it was all just, you know, so he really had never discovered his voice and hadn't really found a range beyond, he really hadn't found a speaking range. Robert was one of the brightest kids I've ever had in youth choir. Again, who very, very, very shy, very withdrawn. His mom was the secretary in our church, and so she desperately wanted him to contribute and sing. Well, we finally got him to choir, and then here, you know, you get this kid, you work for months, and then they're not, you've got to make them successful. You know, you've got to figure out a way to help them be successful. Well, the thing with him was just the shyness was keep inhibiting him. So I worked with him primarily on speaking with energy. And I would give him things to read, and he would read, you know, make a joyful noise unto the Lord. All ye lands, serve the Lord with gladness. And if I just had him read, he would read, make a joyful noise unto the Lord, serve the Lord with gladness. You know, just really almost monotone. And so I worked a lot with speech, and when I got the speech going, then the voice started to come together. And then we started working on the voice. And the great thing about him was by the end of that year, he sang a solo on youth choir tour.
Wow.
On the William Dawson, every time I feel the Spirit, it has a solo, upon the mountain, my Lord spoke. He sang that solo on youth choir tour, which was just, you know, it just didn't get any better than that in terms of great ministry in my estimation. I could name Brian, who was a student who just had very, very limited experience. This was a kid I worked with just in the last 3 or 4 years, very recently. And again, a kid that came to youth choir. I was not directing the youth choir, but the person who was said, what do? I don't know what to do. And I gave some suggestions and gave some help, and it didn't come around. And so I said, well, let me work with it. You know, I'll do this. So we set up these times and started working. Well, what I picked up from him was that I observed a concert at the high school, and he was playing cello in the orchestra, the junior high orchestra. So I thought, you know, if he's playing cello, then we've got some disconnects here. Well, I talked to the orchestra director, who happened to be a friend of mine, and she said, well, he's not very successful as a cellist, really. But what I did was, the way I started working with him was I would say, now I'm gonna hold your music, you know, and I'm gonna be your music stand, Brian. And I want you to just look at this music, and while you're looking at this music, I want you to play this on your cello. And while you're playing this on cello, then I just want you to sing, and we'd sing neutral syllable. And he would move his hand, and I would say, no, you got to play the cello. Keep playing the cello. I mean, practice the fingerings. And then he'd play it on the cello, and then we'd sing it. And if he played it on the cello, most of the time he could get it right. If we did enough of that. So then I had some kids in choir, then he never was to hold his folder, he was always to share so that he could play his cello. And then we started taking the cello away and just having the singing. Now, what he was doing there was making a tactile connection. Okay. Now, I learned that a long, long time ago from a boy that Mrs. Parrish knows, Evan Chancellor, was singing in choir, and in our youth choir, and he was a horn player. And I noticed that anytime we were sight reading, he would be moving his fingers. Okay. And I picked up that there was a connection there. Then I started observing myself, and I started seeing that when I would be sight reading, I would always put my hand in the air, and I'd go like this. And it was playing piano, and I was finding my way. If I can play, you know, the right note, I was getting the right relationship. And I started seeing that connection, that tactile experience. And so figuring out what it is that connects with the person who's having the problem. and finding out how all the different ways that you could connect to make the brain start to connect is really where I think it's important. So, what can these stories tell us? I made some little assessments here, but what are some things that these stories can tell us? What are some things that you've noticed? Maybe some principles or some ideas, some things to keep in mind, and then we'll keep digging a little deeper here. What are some things? Yes,
just different
Chris.
Forms of learning. Because you have the tactile, and then you just got, you know, it's not just play this note. You have to find what system of teaching works best mm-hmm. for the various people.
Yeah. I would encourage you, in terms of your own learning, to try to, you can take tests, I'm sure you can find one online these days, but to find out, are you primarily a visual, aural, kinesthetic, or tactile learner? Okay, in those learning channels. And most of us are not one or the other. I will use different learning channels in different situations, depending on what my task is. But most of us have a different preference. Now, some examples of that, I taught a student a number of years ago that couldn't seem to memorize things. So typically, if you're having a student who has a memorize, it was a voice student. I was teaching voice at the time, and a voice student. Well, we were having so much trouble. You would say, "Well, repeat it over and over." You know, well, what would that do? What channel would that do? If you say, you know, "Kado niu ben," you know, and create, you know, keep on saying it over. What would that do?
Teaches the auditory.
Yeah, it's auditory. You're hearing it, okay? All right, then you would say, well, let's, you know, some of you would say, well, all you have to do is just look at it. If you just keep looking at it, you know, you'll just memorize it. Well, you would. That person might not, okay? So I'll usually say, let's look at it, let's say it out loud, okay? And then how do you work, what do you do with the tactile thing? Touch it. You see, touch the paper, touch the something, write it somewhere else, touch it somewhere else. You know, all of those kinds of things. It's hard with text. Well, this student didn't do well with any of that. And so what's left? The kinesthetic thing. So the gross motor movements, the actions. Well, that works really well if you're talking about English. And then you get into foreign languages, and we really struggle with that. It was really hard. But he was successful, and the student finished a music degree a number of years ago and apparently, you know, managed to do okay. But I was determined that this student wouldn't be classified as not smart just because it was coming for him differently. But I would use an example. Our children at home are both quite, I think they learn, they're smart kids, and I think they learn in a lot of different ways, but they're both way more kinesthetic than I. I'm not very kinesthetic at all. The last thing I will do is get up and be dramatic. You know, that's way down the line for me. Well, you know, at dinner, when we're talking at our house, and we're talking about what happened, our big question is, you know, what's something great that happened in your day? You know, I'm just like, well, you know, it was whatever, and I'm talking about, you know, and all that stuff. Well, our kids invariably, well, it was like this, and they jump up to the table, and she was over here, and I was here, and she runs this way, and I do this, you know, and here we go, you know, and all this stuff. And, you know, and I've tried to learn not to say, now I said sit down. You know, and that kind of thing. Because for them, the memory is in the action, see? The memory, the reliving of the experiences in the action. An example for me is when Brenda and I go shopping. You've heard this before, Owen, in a class. But when Brenda and I go shopping, Brenda says, well, I'm just going to look around. I'm going to just look at this. Well, the first thing she does is go pick up something and touch it. Well, when I say I'm going to look at something, what do? I look at it. The only reason I touch it is to see the price, if it's on the back. But I don't need to touch it. If I'm going to look at it, I just look at it. Yeah. So it's a difference in the way what we say we're going to do. So anyway, that's a little bit about learning stuff. So learning how somebody else learns. And that's way more, there's multiple intelligence theories, and there's a lot of things that I know just enough about to know that they're out there. But there's a lot of ways to think about learning. What else? What are some other things that you saw or you heard maybe in some of these stories?
Emotional issues.
Okay, emotional issues, yeah. How many of you have gone through a period where you didn't sing well and you felt like it was based on, you know, just kind of where you were emotionally? Yeah, most of us. Emotion is everything in singing. Everything is not true, but it's huge. If the environment is not safe, how many of you have studied with a voice teacher that you believed didn't believe you could sing? Or didn't really believe in you as much as you thought? You don't function well for that teacher. Because if you feel you can be successful, it's so important. It matters so much. So the emotional safety stuff. Go through a very, very difficult time, and it's almost as if it can take your voice away. It almost can take your voice from you. So when somebody's dealing with something very difficult, it can be, we have to find those safe places and create them. One of my major goals in working with the Baylor Men's Choir through the years is to create a safe environment. I want every day when those guys come to that room, I want this to be a sanctuary for them. And I want it to be a place that they come and they say, everything is okay in this room. And if it isn't okay, it's okay not to be okay. But I want it to be safe. And in that kind of environment, oh, the music that can come forth, you know, is usually better than anything we ever perform. But that's not the most important thing we do. The lives are the most important thing. Yeah. Okay, what else? What are some other things?
Well, from a ministry point of view, I think it's neat to see that you kind of embrace the conflicting goals of participation and excellence.
Yeah.
I mean, those are two things that are important in modern music ministry, yet they conflict so often.
Yeah.
And I think it's important things to think about.
Is excellence a moving target? Or is it a stationary target?
That's where stewardship comes
from.
Okay, I think you're right. Why is excellence a moving target?
Because it's different for every person, every ensemble.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. It's where we've grown today.
That's
where
right.
Yeah.
In the future.
That's right. If excellence were a stable, were one place, then many of us would be subpar. and we would not be allowed to participate. But excellence is always... It's about becoming. I think excellence has I am working toward becoming more. I am achieving. I am giving my best. And it's all that. But it isn't the same for every person, for everything. And I think our culture speaks so incorrectly to that. We have a culture of, if I'm not good, I don't try. Okay. And I've just done some writing about some of that. And I'm concerned that we have a culture that says the professional sports culture, the professional music culture, you know, we go to listen. We listen, I applaud for you, you do this, I encourage you, but, you know, I don't do whatever. And I tell my students all the time, something you never say in my presence is, I don't do whatever. Well, you might not have done it yet, but that doesn't mean you don't do it. You know, we experience lots of things, and life is about experience. And I'm sorry that some things that I don't do very well, like play sports. You know, I would really like to play sports if we could just play. You know, and we didn't have to be always so competitive, or it's only the good kids that get to play. You know, we need some places in our world, and if the church can't be a place where we all participate, what's left, friends? What's left? Michelle?
I think in all your stories, it seems that everybody found a place to serve. It didn't necessarily always end up being in the music ministry, but you didn't just go, oh, well, you suck. Go find somewhere else.
Yeah. You know, and when somebody comes to choir and they choose to come to choir or come to music ministry experience, then that's a compliment. It means that they, in some way, felt that might be a community for them. And if there's a place, and then it's up to us to find that community. A church I served years ago in Kansas City, our pastor had this great, great, great big heart and just loved. I mean, he taught me so much about loving sort of disenfranchised people. But we had this kind of a halfway house for people that were transitioning from mental facilities that was in our community. And we had a lot of people from that home, pretty much the whole crowd that would come to our church. Well, our church, at that point, choir was really kind of the really community moment. People were really engaging in choir. Well, he thought, you know, he was doing everybody a favor by funneling them all into choir. So we were having a number of, you know, interesting visitors. But, you know, I had to think about that and just say, this is good, you know. I still see people from that church, and they have funny stories. This is a woman who raised her hand one day, and we were sitting, and she stood up before me. She said, "May I go to the bathroom?" And I said, "Sure." You know, and it was just an adult in the middle of a choir rehearsal, you know. And this other woman came and was talking about her that she had gone that day and gotten Norplant or whatever, the birth control implant, you know, telling me about the whole procedure and, you know, and everything. So it was a whole other culture kind of experience for me, yeah. You know. But you know, hey, I learned a lot. You know. What are some other things you've heard from some of the stories?
Yeah. You know, you were referring to that excellence thing. I have a friend that's even beyond my age, and she told me when she was young, she studied music, but she never felt that she was good enough, and so she never played out in front of anyone. Oh my gosh, this lady can tear up the piano. And there was just one day, somebody obviously gave her that concept, there is not one excellence, you know. And I have found that with my high school students over and over again. I'm not good enough to be able to sing. And I'm like, oh, really? Yeah, let's see about that. You know, but I find that that seems to be an overriding issue with a lot of students right now, that they assume that they're not good enough because they've heard somebody on television that they're the best, okay?
Yeah.
So I can't even come up to that or even get near that, so I'm not good enough. So.
Or somebody told them once that they couldn't.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's the worst.
Or made a statement that made them feel that way. And that's so hard to overcome.
But it's amazing that it still plays now. I remember way back, you know, there were only a few good people, it seemed like, but, you know, that was sort of the concept that was out there. But even today, it plays over and over again in young people's minds.
Yeah. And it's particularly hard with musicians, I think, and it's particularly hard with people who have had high level of musical training. I sometimes will tell our students that if you're in the business school and if you make really bad grades on your test, if you don't tell anybody and you don't talk very much in class, everybody will assume you're smart. It's up to you. If you tell them, then no. Otherwise, it's very private. But in the music school, it's not private. You know, even things like sometimes in theory class, you know, you go down the line and you sing this off and you sing this and everybody, you know, and everybody knows, you know. I was in Kenya a few weeks ago, and we spent a day in a school with a group of a girls' school. And one of the things we did was visit classes the very first thing we got there in the morning. And I was the first one in our little group, because I'm always eager, I guess. But anyway, I walked in, and they wanted to sit at a desk. There was like a little desk like this, a lot smaller, and two girls at each desk. And so I sat down by the two girls, actually between the two girls, and we had this, everybody gets to have a little conversation. Well, I was sitting by these girls, and I said, well, you know, do you enjoy school? Oh, absolutely. And then they eventually say, you know, I find out that they are really smart. So I said, well, you know, you guys are, you know, really speak well, and, you know, you've got a lot of great ideas. Well, we're the smartest girls in this class, and these are the two seats that every girl wants to be in this class. And it goes from here, this way, down this way, and that's the bad spot.
Yeah. Nice. Difficult.
Now, for these girls, this was, and they said, you know, we have to work really hard to maintain this position, but this means we're going to get to go on high school. You know, we should be ready to go and function at the next level. But I tell music students that in music school, people, you know, in reality, you can be sized up all the time. because people say, you know, she's the best this, he's the best that, she's the that, he's the that, whatever. And it's kind of like kindergarten. You know, in kindergarten, our kids would say, oh, he's the best runner, you know. And our kids both in elementary school could tell you every single kid in the class and how they ranked on certain just normal childhood things. Well, the church is not that kind of place. And we have to be continually the leveler of that. And in our training, we have to unlearn some of our other stuff. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that we always are just playing around down here in the mud. You see? Because people, when they come to choir, this is not philosophy class, but when they come to choir, they're coming because they know they want to sing better with a group than they sing by themselves. That's, or they want to be with people. Okay? So that means they want to be better, and that means that's up to us to help them raise this level, not to stay where they are. When we allow people to stay where they are, then we're saying, I can't help you. I don't know how to help you. It's a parent who says, I have nothing to teach you. Okay? Let's look at a few other things here. Voice classification is really important. Getting a person in the right voice part is really, really important. And like the woman who needed to be singing tenor, it's okay. I wouldn't put, you know, a seventh grade girl, I wouldn't put her in the tenor section. I would say, you know, we've got a lot of vocal development here, you know, there's a lot of places for you to grow here. But, you know, an adult who is struggling already, go where you need to go. You know, do what you need to do. It's really okay. It's really okay. I've had a number of women through the years that sang in the tenor section, and some of them were anchors, you know, and it mattered. And you certainly have to learn not to say, you know, men and women, you know. Have to really get your language together, which we ought to get together anyway. Another thing is that we must assist. It is our responsibility, our role, to assist. But what that can be delightful for you, too. You know, some of us are bored in our ministries because we don't do anything new. And we're not looking for those places to keep growing and those edges. What's the worst thing that can happen if you don't help somebody?
They could keep getting worse and worse.
Okay.
They could feel worse and worse about themselves.
Okay. If you do help them, what's the worst thing that can happen?
They
could stay the same.
Yeah.
The worst thing that could happen is they stay the same. Or they could say, you know, he tried to help me, and even, you know, with, you know, Landry helping me, I didn't improve, you know. But that's really not a real big thing. And I really do think I've never worked with anybody that didn't make some progress. They wouldn't say, I enjoyed the process, at least.
I think the worst thing that would happen is that you deny yourself the opportunity to serve.
Yes.
And that's what we're here for.
That's right. It's really about ministry. It really is. People usually succeed. They usually succeed, and they usually succeed probably beyond your expectations. You're just trying to help them kind of get into a neutral place, and oftentimes people succeed quite well. I've seen that happen at all levels, with children, with adults, with college students who, you know, weren't the brightest or weren't the most talented, it seemed, and just achieved, you know, dramatically. So you really, really never, it's not up to us to be the decider of what the potential is. That's really not our role. People who don't want help will decide singing is too much work. If you have somebody that comes to choir and you offer them assistance, and they say, you know, I'm sorry, I can't meet you 15 minutes before choir. And you say, well, you know, I would really like to help you. I think it would make this experience a lot more enjoyable for you. Give them some reasons and things like that. And then they still just really don't, you know, don't get any help. Most of the time they will self-identify to go do something different.
And sometimes be very effective in that new thing.
That's right.
They go
That's right.
And help their self-esteem and help the people around them.
That's right.
They don't have to be musicians.
That's right. And you can launch them into some other places, and
especially
that can be a really good thing.
But if they make that decision.
That's right. They need to make that decision. I have never told somebody, I think you need to go do something else. And I have never been passive aggressive in making that happen either. I can honestly tell you, I have not done that. And sometimes you can't even be afraid that your, quote, good singers are going to leave because, you know, of this other issue. But you better work hard helping this other person find a place, you know, and get up to par, which is can almost always happen. Hearing issues must be addressed. Hearing issues really, that's the one place where this is pretty much insurmountable. I had a kid one time that I worked and worked and worked and worked with who never made any progress, and we never matched the same pitch twice. And I know it was a hearing thing, and she was from a very disadvantaged background. And, you know, today I think, you know, 30 years later, I think I could find her help, but I didn't have any clue where in those days to go to help.
Have you ever used a PVC pipe?
I have. You know what, like when you have a crooked pipe where you can sing in this end and hear through here? I haven't used that regularly, but I have.
Helpful.
Yeah.
Especially with adults who understand that they're hearing instead of it being diffused.
Yeah, and recording, you know, all those things are really, really big keys. Movement is closely related. A person that typically, a person can't sing in tune, they also can't keep a steady beat. I discovered that a long, long time ago because I was teaching a choir class in my first year teaching high school. And I had a choir class, a band director, but I had a choir class. Well, I had this kid that signed up for choir class and she couldn't sing in tune and I didn't know any way to help her. So I thought, well, I'll get her in the band. We need some girls in the color guard. Well, we got her in the color guard. I mean, she could not march. But she was smart. I mean, she made good grades and stuff, but she couldn't connect that. Well, I started noticing, and so often, if you can't keep a steady beat, then you won't sing in tune. Now, I don't know what all the scientific things, I know some of that's been studied, but that's one of the reasons that steady beat is important, which we'll get to again in a moment. Not every situation works out ideally. It doesn't always work like you want it to. One-on-one help is a must. And I say with children that if a child is not matching pitch by third grade, then you must help the child individually. If the child has been a part of musical readiness and the child is not succeeding, you've got to step in at that point before you get to a critical stage and you get, you know, voice change and puberty and all that. So one-on-one is important. Create a supportive environment. So you might not have good success until the person starts to trust you, until you can learn to play with your voice, in a sense. Most of us can make lots of important sounds if we could just be playful enough to do that. I remember saying to my voice teacher in college in my sophomore year, finally there was this day that she said, "That's what I've been trying to get you to do." And I said, "Well, I could have done that the first day I was in here. I just didn't know that's what you wanted." I mean, I made that sound plenty of times on my own. I just didn't know that would please her. So we had not experimented enough. So when I used to teach voice, I used to say, "Please show me every voice you have. Show me all the things you think I would think are horrible." You know. With high school kids, you know, a lot of times you can catch them in the act of imitation.
Uh-huh.
Sure. You know, they're imitating something that they think is crazy, and you say, "That's it. That's what we want. That's what we want." You must not pretend. The person usually knows if he or she has challenges. You really don't do people a favor by saying, it's no problem. That's not helpful. If they can't trust you, if you're not telling the truth, they will never trust you. And you're talking about your own field. So you're an expert in this field. So if you told them something not true about something that you don't know anything about, that's one thing. But when you're the musician and you tell them the wrong thing, you can't do that. What are some steps that you would take in a one-on-one encounter? Ask them to sing something that they know and like. So, you know, if I were to say, "Owen, what's a song that you like?"
"Amazing Grace."
Okay, and that's one you'll get a lot of times. And say, "Well, could you sing Amazing Grace for me?" You know, and then Owen starts singing Amazing Grace. Well, by the time we get to that first interval, I'll know a lot. You know, you'll know a ton. Why would that be a good song if he were to happen to choose that song? It's also pentatonic.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
So you don't have any half steps to negotiate, which are going to be a whole lot harder. Let's get the whole steps first.
Right.
Half steps will be a lot more difficult. But, you know, somebody says, oh, I don't know any songs. Well, what do you know Amazing Grace? Do you know My Country, 'Tis of Thee? And just give them some ideas. And usually they'll come up with something, Happy Birthday or something that they can sing. And then you'll know, because whatever pitch he starts on is going to be a comfortable pitch for him. And you'll know a lot about where he's comfortable, where he, you know, you can assess a whole lot from the very beginning. So you are assessing key and range. You know, if he gets the bottom notes, da 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 da, not successful. Okay. Then you're gonna know, you know, it's this point, or then you change the key and you see if he could come to your key. You know, in just a few minutes of trying some things, you'll know a ton. Correct or incorrect intervals, you know, which ones were, is it big skips, is he getting steps, not skips, all that. Is the rhythm correct or not? That will help you know a whole lot there. You'll have a sense of musicality and you'll have a lot about beat. Did the person sing correctly within some of the range? And then you'll have some good ideas there. Start from where they are. So you take their key, you start from that spot, and then you go, you start from there. So if he sings da-dum, then, and that's successful, da-dum, and then we're going to go very well from there, then you could start da-da-da-dum, sing with me, da-da-dum, have them move your hand with me, da-da-dum, you know, and then da-da-da-da-dum, da-da-dum, yeah, and move your hand. If you're not successful, let's stand, please, you know, and then you move and more. It's really hard to move your body and not move your voice. Almost every time, if you can get somebody to move their body, you can almost never go opposite your body. It's even hard as a trained person. It's really hard to move your hand down when you're singing up. It's just really hard to do. And if you're not very trained, then it's even more difficult. Go slowly. The first time you're with somebody, it may only last a few moments. Not a few moments, but, you know, it may be 10 minutes, you know, and that may be enough, and you don't need to tell them so much. Most of us, you know, we don't need to start talking about vocal physiology and, you know, the laryngeal positions and all those things, that, you know, resonators and stuff like that, you know, just go slow. Often the challenge is one of the following. The person has a limited range and it must be expanded. They sing within two or three notes. Failure to distinguish singing voice from a speaking voice. That's the most common in my somewhat limited experience. I call it elongated speech. You know, you say sing, well, what they do is just string the words together. So they just string the words together. You know, take speech. My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, and they just kind of connect the words and really don't put melody with it, but it's just elongated speech. The lack of support system. So what it takes to sing is a different support than it takes to speak. So if you don't have the breath there, then you won't have the singing. See, the singing cannot happen without the breath. So oftentimes the elongated speech thing just means they're singing Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that, but I'm not really breathing like I would be breathing to sing, so I'm not breathing enough to support a tone. I even have that happen with students in the School of Music who are students in another major, and they don't make the connection that for me to play trumpet, I use the same breath. I still have to have breath to sing. And they're not really connecting that same usage, see, from one spot to another. And for a lot of you, you think, well, how can anybody not do this? You know what? Well, let's do one more little thing here. Think for a moment. If I were to ask you to sing the pitch, ask you to hum that pitch. Let's think for a second. What do you have to do to hum that pitch? It's the first thing you have to do. Well, first thing, you have to hear it. So the sound has to come through, has to enter your body through your ear. Then what does your ear have to do?
Process.
Okay, sends it to the brain. Okay, then your brain determines
the vocal cords position.
Well,
pitch.
It has to determine the number of vibrations per second for that pitch. That's very complicated, isn't it? But Jeff, your brain has to decipher how many vibrations, what's the timbre, or the, not the timbre, the pitch. Yeah, the vibrations that make that pitch, you know, whatever, 440 or whatever. You know, has to decide that, okay? Then what happens? Has to send a message. Okay, but you got to get the breath. You got to open the mouth. You got to let the sound come, breath come in. You got to put it in the right place. All that breathing. Breathing's a big thing itself, okay? So we already asked people, wow, just breathing's hard. All right, then you have to set the larynx. Give space. Okay. All right, resonance.
You're breathing.
Okay. All that. Now, how long do we give somebody to do that?
Seconds.
Like that. Do you realize how it should be that none of us are able to sing? Yeah. Now, can you imagine in a typical choir rehearsal how many notes we might sing in one choir rehearsal? Hundreds. Hundreds. Hundreds of them. Now, isn't it a miracle that God has allowed us to sing? And shouldn't we not be so tough on people who don't do it very easily? So, see, you just do it. Like, I mean, it's nothing for us. It's nothing for us. And then we say, you know, sing... Da 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 dum bum ba dum bum. You know that tune, but anyway, you know, we sing it, and you know, something made up. You know, musicians just do all these things. So you see how we need to be patient? Okay. So poor tonal models. Sometimes people have just not had any tonal models and they've not connected with singers, particularly boys, I think, haven't been around any singers, and they another thing with boys is the vocal change and the singing through that and figuring out how it was different to sing as a boy and as a man and how do I work with this. You know, if you think of a boy, I try to see a junior high boy as, you know, like, you know, dressed in many, many, many clothes and wearing shoes that are five times too big and they're about to fall over everything all the time. And then if you think of within just a few weeks, your larynx could be three times the size it was. Like, can you imagine how that would be to walk around and suddenly you were three times the size you were? And how would you negotiate the world? Okay, again, bringing the temperature down a little bit. Health concerns, environment, smoking, hearing, all those things can really affect your singing and your ability to sing well, and a person's ability to sing well. Steady beat and rhythm concerns sometimes go back to preschool, lack of pre-singing experiences. And see, to get to the place of all those singing, what about all the vocal exploration things that we do to get to the place of singing? All the things about using our voice and movement and breathing and all those things we do with preschoolers. So sometimes to take the adult back and have the pre-singing experiences. Wrong voice classification. Is acceptable for an adult. I think that's true. A non-traditional voice part, salvage the person always, important. Emotional challenges, we talked about that. Failure to connect learning styles, we talked about that. When you work with the person, give them homework. Send them away with something to do. Say, here are some things I want you to work on. Make a recording of this. You know, send it, I would still probably have to use a tape recorder, but you know, you could. My computer will do all that. I'm just not sure I can get it to do all that. You know, and I can send it. You can send it to them, and they can sing along with this recording, and they can sing along with the vocal stuff. But get them, give them something to do. Make them a part take. Anybody that's going to sing in the choir, if they're having parts, you having problems, you sit down with them and make them a recording. Okay. Should the recording be somebody singing, or should it be just the piano playing?
Somebody singing.
Why?
Good example.
Modeling. Right.
Modeling.
You say, sound just like this piano.
Yeah.
Now, what?
Yeah.
How dumb is that? Who would you want to sound like a bong? Sound like a piano. See, we say all these things that we don't mean at all. You know, we mean the same pitch, but that's not what we said at all. We may be playing it an octave away from where we expect them to sing it, and we're expecting them to make that thing. Set up a regular appointment. You're doing a lot to say, if somebody comes regularly, they want to do this. If they're not willing to do this and set aside some time, then you're both getting some good important messages here. Monitor the progress. Keep monitoring the progress even after they're beginning to be independent. Moving forward, placement within the choir. A placement within a choir is a musical decision, but it's also an emotional decision. So you have to place people where they can be safe and successful. And every choir has those places. And I think seating, some kind of seating charts are ideal. It's hard to keep those in a church choir because people tend to just migrate back to where they want to be. But some people need some level of protection. And there's some people in choirs that don't need to be by unsuccessful, sometimes unsuccessful people because they're not tolerant. I mean, we all know some of those people who just wouldn't be the good person to sit somebody by. The choir that I was most recently in a church for a number of years, there was a man in our choir, a delightful man, Don Corley, who's spoken at this conference a number of different times. He's a psychologist, and if we had some guy that was having trouble in our choir, would always say, you know, Don, would you, you know, sit by this guy and tell him privately, and you know, he's having a little bit of struggle, and can you encourage and, you know, be there to help and that kind of thing. And he would kind of befriend the guy, you know, and it would start to work out, and a lot of times it would be successful. Like a guy that's singing an octave lower all the time, and, you know, you're trying to get him to move up and things, you know, things that are not insurmountable, but they need somebody to gently help you know when you're doing it or not. Dealing with the hard cases. What do you do after not succeeding after an appropriate amount of time? And I think we've touched on that. You help launch somebody somewhere else, maybe give them some time, help them find, you know, you'll just have to decide. You'll know whether, you'll know the person, and you'll know what this person needs or doesn't need. Check in on them, monitoring short and longer term needs. That's something we continue to do. And I think so many times we don't keep checking on people that we've tried to help or people that we've helped. Now, some questions, and I gave you a very, very old article, but you can access this online because I checked to be sure. So you can find it. You might have to pay a little bit or something, but you can get it. Michelle.
What do you do with, I mean, I know we all have good attitudes with those that can't sing for the most part. What do you do with the rest of your ministry team, like your choir or your worship team that does not have a good attitude and complains about them when they're not around?
I would try to just gently lead them around without preaching to them and without trying to be too hard on them, because it is frustrating. We'll try this sometimes. Last Christmas, I was in this interim music ministry position, and they had already contracted with somebody else to lead the Christmas music when I started there in October. It was a great experience because the other person was wonderful. I mean, you know, I love singing with her. It was great. But I sang in the choir. Well, everybody sings, you know, there's not anybody out of tune, they're just not in tune. Not on my standards. And I found it challenging sometimes to sing in the bass section just around the people that we say are successful. And that sounds really haughty, you know, to say that. And I was nice about it, and I helped them, and we worked, and, you know, we kind of developed a little team of four, you know, and all that stuff. But still, even with people that were successful, you know, it was hard sometimes because, you know, it's real hard to stay right when somebody's really, really wrong around you, and they're adamantly wrong. I mean, it's hard. It's very difficult. And so it gave me some patience with the people who are sort of not very kind sometimes. But your attitude will determine everything. I so believe that over time, our attitude determines the ministry. It's a lot to carry, but I think it's true.
I could say a couple more things about that placement within the choir. I think you have to be careful if you have this uncertain singer. You have to put them by somebody who's very strong. It ends up sometime where you get two weak people together,
yep.
And then
yep.
The one who could do it if they weren't bothered.
While you're thinking about that, another component of that is if this weaker person has a big voice, then you've got to think about that too. I try to put the big voice by the accurate voice so that the accurate singer can make sure the big voice is accurate, you know, and team these people up together. So a lot of what I try to do is based on those kind of things, you know.
I know. The other thing was sometimes we put them side by side. and it might be more effective to put the strong singer
behind.
Yeah.
Hear better.
Yeah. I seat mostly by strong people, strong, next strong, next strong, next strong. With the Baylor Men's Choir, I do a number of other things, but it's pretty much strong back to front. And a lot of times the better singers don't like to be on the back. They like to be in the middle. But if you're not passing that sound down, by the time you get if the weak person's on the back, there's not a chance. You know, even the just not really weak, but just not independent, terribly independent person. Yeah. So that's a great point. Other questions or suggestions? Yes.
I've been asked. I don't think other people in the choir like me. Should I just drop out? My answer to that is, it's not your choir. It's not my choir. It's God's choir. Of course you will. And that seems to make people feel that.
Yeah.
To follow that question, how far would you go in trying to solve that problem, or would you let it lie and just deal with the individual? I mean, you're talking about a safe place in men's choir. Would that be something that you try to apply there, or how would you deal with that situation?
Yeah. I would just talk to the person. Why do you feel that way? What's led you to feel that way? Tell me some more. Listening is everything, see. You know, most of the time, if we can allow the person, they will solve a lot of their problem, or they'll give you enough input that you'll know what the thing is. So, you know, what's going on? How did you feel? What happened? You know, how do you know that? How did you feel that way? You know, those kind of things. Just lots of questioning, and then kind of assess.
So rather than policing, you're talking about, let's just try to isolate one-on-one and not make it I'm the enforcer.
If you have in a choir, your goal is not to draw attention to any one person.
Right.
So what you're trying to do is make everybody at a minimal acceptability. And then we try to move the acceptable level up all the time. So we're trying to move the minimum up constantly. So when we have a very weak person, we have to bring that person up to get the average up.
One of the ways I've improved that situation is giving the choir the vision of who they are and why they're there. You know, they're not there for me. You know, they're not there to just have fun. You know, what is our vision as servants of the Lord? And because of that, because they have grasped that, I've squelched that situation.
Yeah. Good. I think our time is up. Thank you. I'm sorry we didn't have quite enough time for some more questions, but thank you so much for coming today. I'm honored by your presence and appreciate it.
Thank you again for listening to this podcast. To learn more about the Alleluia Conference, visit us online at www.baylor.edu/alleluia.